November 29th, 1992.
Good evening, Rabbi Gordon.
Good evening, Charlie. I want to join you in expressing our admiration for my nephew Larry, or Leiby as I call him, for the pioneer work that he had done in bringing programs of Jewish content and music to the younger Jewish community. In yesterday's Sedra, the Torah relates that Isaac dug several wells. The first few of these wells fell into the hands of the Philistines. However, Isaac continued digging to uncover the wells of living water. Isaac's way of life was digging wells, removing earth and stones until fresh fountains of living water sprang up of their own accord. He did not pour water into the wells, but brought forth their own source of living water. Isaac's conduct paralleled his spiritual way of life. For in the spiritual sense, he was also a digger of wells. Throughout his life, he attempted to remove the earth and stones, the mask of materiality and corporeality of the physical world, and thereby reveal the wells of living water, the spirituality of all matter. Isaac was undismayed by the dust and dirt obstructing his path to the springs of water. He was also undeterred by the antagonism of the Philistines and their king Abimelech. Moreover, even when several of the precious and hard-earned wells fell into Philistine hands, Isaac continued to dig. Logically, we might think that Isaac should have been discouraged by the obstacles in his path. Abimelech was, after all, the ruling monarch in that region. What is more, Isaac saw that his attempts up to that time had met with failure. However, Isaac did not analyze the situation with cold logic. He knew that his divine mission in life was to dig wells, in the spiritual as well as the physical sense. And he committed himself to this task with a self-sacrificing devotion and with the conviction that he would eventually reach the source of living water. It is relatively easy for a Jew to live in the spirituality of the pleasant atmosphere of Torah study and prayer, but this is insufficient. One must also try to influence others. One should even become involved with those individuals who on the surface seem to be earth and stones. It is necessary to dig beneath the surface until their hidden fountains of living water, their Jewish souls, spring forth of their own accord. Also, one must be undismayed by the earth and dust that meets the eye, and undeterred by any opposition or antagonism. For Torah philosophy emphasizes that there is a divine spark within each and every Jew. Hence, we are like a person who digs at a spot where he knows there is water, and with selfless devotion and determination will eventually reach the fountain of living water, the godliness within each person. Ultimately, we will reach the day of the coming of Mashiach, of which the prophet Isaiah says, "And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and together all flesh shall see that the mouth of the Lord has spoken." Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Shalom Gordon of
I hope that the sound levels came through. I apologize that I don't have sophisticated recording equipment to adjust the sound levels. On the next Devar Torah, unfortunately, we missed the first couple of seconds, but this is for December 6, 1992.
Sheba and went towards Haran. Beersheba epitomized peace and security. There he had lived a life of prayer and study far removed from mundane affairs. However, when the time came for him to marry and beget the 12 tribes of Israel, he had to leave this atmosphere of spiritual comfort and go to Haran to work as a simple shepherd in the fields. Many nowadays ask, God has given us so many precepts to fulfill. Wherever one turns, in whichever surroundings one happens to be, there is always a positive commandment to fulfill or a negative precept to observe. If God wants us to observe so many laws and customs, why doesn't he lighten our material burden? Why didn't he make it easier to earn a livelihood? If we weren't plagued by so many worries and responsibilities, we would be more free to observe his mitzvahs, to go even further. Why didn't God see to it that we live altogether detached from the world in a quiet spiritual atmosphere of Torah study and prayer? Why does he want us to live in the world, to be part of a human society, and yet to observe his precepts in order, in other words, to live a spiritual life in a material world? This question is the exact parallel of the question that we can ask concerning Jacob's journey from Beersheba to Choron. Jacob was to become the Pchir Shebeoves, the select of the forefathers, to beget 12 sons and rear them in such a way that they would become fitting founders of the godly 12 tribes of Israel. They had to be brought up in a spiritual way of life. Surely the atmosphere and environment most conducive to such an upbringing would have been the spiritual surroundings of Beersheba. The Torah tells us otherwise. Jacob was to leave Beersheba and become the father of the 12 tribes in Choron, in the house of Laban the swindler, while laboring as a shepherd under extreme conditions. It's true that he stopped on the way in the school of Eber and prepared himself for 14 years. However, despite these severe handicaps, Jacob did succeed in establishing the house of Israel, and to such an extent that all his children were loyal Jews, not as Abraham, who gave birth to Ishmael, or Isaac, whose eldest son was the wicked Esau. The answer to the above two questions is, an olive yields its best oil when it is pounded and squashed. Similarly, when a Jew is tested by exposure to the foreign influences of an outside environment, his finest qualities come to the fore. And when he withstands the test, he can build the house of Israel, establish a Jewish home, aglow with the light and warmth of Torah and mitzvahs, and ultimately light up the dark world and prepare it for the Geula Shlema. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
December 13th, 1992.
For his weekly commentary. Good evening, Rabbi Gordon.
Good evening, Charlie. Tonight and tomorrow, we Hasidim celebrate the festival of Yitzchak Kislev, commemorating the liberation from the Tsarist prison of Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi, the founder of Chabad Hasidism. Rabbi Shneur Zalman, known as the Alter Rebbe, was a disciple of the Mezritcher Magid, who was the successor of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement. The historic day of Yitzchak Kislev was more than a personal triumph for Rabbi Shneur Zalman. In regaining on that day his personal freedom, and the freedom to continue his teachings and work, he gained a victory for the entire Hasidic movement, which had been threatened with suppression and extinction. For the Alter Rebbe was the chief exponent of the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov, who had founded the Hasidic movement about a half a century earlier. It is for this reason that he was made the chief target of attack by the opponents of Hasidism, and his redemption brought salvation to the numerous followers of the Baal Shem Tov and to our people as a whole. One of the great achievements of the Baal Shem Tov is that he has revealed the true nature of a Jew. While he dedicated his life to the spreading of Torah and mitzvahs in the fullest measure, he never despaired of any Jew, no matter how much circumstances had temporarily overshadowed his Judaism. The Baal Shem Tov taught, and the Alter Rebbe expounded upon it at length, that a Jew was essentially, by his very nature, inseparable from God, that no Jew is either able or willing to detach himself from godliness. It is often necessary to do more, no more than to scratch the surface, and the Jew's true inner nature is revealed. The Baal Shem Tov introduced a new brotherly relationship between Jews based on the inner meaning of have we not all one father? By the personal example of his own dedicated work, he taught us what our attitude and approach to our fellow Jews should be. The Baal Shem Tov began his work as an assistant melamed, a teacher's aide, taking tender care of little children and teaching them the Shema, blessings, and other simple prayers. At the same time, he revealed to the mature minds of his great disciples some of the profound teachings of Kabbalah and the true way to serve God with heart and mind. This profound philosophy found its systematic expression and exposition in Chabad Hasidism. Nowadays, more than ever, it is the duty and privilege of every Jew to help educate Jewish children. Children in the literal sense, in age, and children in knowledge of Judaism. As the present Lubavitcher Rebbe, may he have a complete recovery, once said, one's years are not to be measured by a birth certificate. An elder of 70 years may in truth be like a baby crawling on all fours. In a true sense, one's education is not confined to the school bench. It must continue throughout life. One should try to become wiser and better every day. Thus, one must be a student and teacher at the same time. And in both cases, success depends on mutual affection, the true Ahavas Yisrael, love of one's fellow Jew, which atones for the sin of sinas chinam, undeserved hatred, which brought about our exile, and its opposite, real Ahavas Yisrael, will speed our redemption. Thank you.
December 20th, 1992.
For the rabbi's weekly commentary. Good evening, Rabbi Gordon.
Good evening, Charlie. In yesterday's Seder Vayeshev, we read how Joseph became a servant in the house of Potiphar, a high officer of Pharaoh. Potiphar's wife attempted time and time again through devious means to seduce Joseph. When all her efforts failed, she grasped hold of his garment, thinking that now he could not elude her. Joseph, however, slipped out of his coat and, leaving it behind in her hand, ran away. It is significant that the most modern and progressive circles in Judaism have not succeeded in attracting our youth. All the social attractions and intellectual bait displayed by different Jewish organizations have failed to win the hearts of the younger generation and to stem the flood of their alienation from Judaism. In the episode of Potiphar's wife, we may perhaps find the clue to this phenomenon. The essence of a Jew is his spiritual aspect, the neshama, or soul. His body is merely a vessel, a form of clothing for the soul. It is the neshama that is the true inner personality of the Jew. Thus, all attempts to use material and physical attractions to capture our youth are doomed to failure. The most beautiful Jewish community centers may be built, featuring ultra-modern gymnasiums and luxurious swimming pools. Exciting dances may be arranged, dynamic speakers may be hired to speak on topics of Jewish interest, but all these well-intended endeavors will not ultimately solve the problem of the alienated Jewish younger generation. For no matter how much we may cater to the physical tastes of our youth in order to attract them to Judaism, we are ultimately left like Potiphar's wife holding an empty garment. We have failed to communicate with their true selves. We have failed to satisfy their true desires. A patient may develop external symptoms of an internal disorder. An incompetent doctor would spend his time and energies endeavoring to cure the symptoms. Although the symptoms may temporarily be relieved by his therapy, their root cause, the internal illness, remains and may even become worse. An experienced physician, however, will seek to diagnose the true cause of the symptoms, the disease, and by healing of the disease, the symptoms will automatically vanish. This example vividly illustrates the current situation of our Jewish youth, their unrest, their spirit of rebellion against parents, teachers, and society in general, their frantic search for meaning in life, their straying onto strange paths of hippiedom and drug-taking. These are all symptoms of a sickness. The sickness is the thirsting of their neshama for godliness and Torah, a thirst which cannot be quenched by artificial or bodily attractions, but only through drawing them with warmth and sincere friendship closer to a Torah-guided life. This was also the secret of the victory of the Maccabees over the Hellenists. The Hellenists were only offering garments, while the Maccabees touched the very root of the the Jewish soul. A happy Hanukkah to all of you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
December 27th, 1992.
Good evening, Rabbi Gordon.
Good evening, Charlie. Although Hanukkah is celebrated for only 8 days in the year, its message and the message of the Hanukkah lights are valid and compelling all year round. We have two other important lights in our faith. The lights of the seven-branched menorah candelabrum that was lit daily in the Beis Hamikdash, the sanctuary in Jerusalem, and the Sabbath lights, kindled in the Jewish home every Friday evening. However, there are three noteworthy points of distinction between the Hanukkah lights and the two other lights. A. The Sabbath candles must be lit before sunset, and the lights in the Beis Hamikdash were lit even earlier. The Hanukkah lights, however, must be kindled after sunset when it is already dark. B. The menorah of the Beis Hamikdash was inside, in an inner sanctuary. The place of the Sabbath lights is likewise indoors on the Shabbos table. The Hanukkah lights, however, are to be kindled in such a place that their light should be seen outside. C. Finally, the lights of the Beis Hamikdash and of the Sabbath remain the same in number and are uninkreased, while the number of Hanukkah lights are increased every night. The message of Hanukkah is important and timely to all Jews, but even more so to those who live in surroundings with comparatively little Jewish activity. It is precisely in such circumstances that Hanukkah offers a useful lesson. The lesson which seems to be indicated by the Hanukkah lights is that the Jew must not only light up the home as do the Sabbath candles and the synagogue and yeshiva, substituting for the sanctuary of old, but he has the additional responsibility of lighting up the outside, his social and business environments. Moreover, when conditions are unfavorable, it is dark outside. It is then not enough to kindle a light and maintain it, although this is also an achievement, for even a little light of Torah and mitzvahs can dispel a great deal of darkness. But it is necessary to increase the light steadily through steadily growing efforts to spread the light of Torah and mitzvahs. These ever-growing efforts contain in themselves the assurance of ever-growing success until we will merit to see the full light of the Geula, of the redemption, which will drive away completely the darkness of the Golos. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Gordon.
January 3rd, 1993.
Good evening, Rabbi Gordon.
Good evening, Charlie. Yesterday's Sedra Vayigash relates how Joseph revealed his true identity to his brothers and was reunited with them. It is stated in the Sedra that when the brothers had first come to Egypt and had met Joseph, Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Why did the brothers fail to recognize Joseph? The simple explanation given by Rashi is that many years had elapsed since they had last seen him. They left him a young man unbearded, and now he was a fully bearded adult, and that's why they didn't recognize him. Hasidism offers a different interpretation of the verse, and Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. The sons of Jacob had all chosen to be shepherds, quiet and peaceful occupation. Out in the fields, tending their flocks, they had little contact with the social life of the country and were undisturbed in their service of God, in their worship and study. The brothers of Joseph felt it necessary to select an occupation which would facilitate their leading a God-fearing life. They did not wish to live in an environment that would place temptations in their chosen path. Joseph, however, was in this respect superior to them. He was able to occupy the highest administrative position in the mightiest nation of that era and yet remain righteous. The brothers did not recognize and could not comprehend that the viceroy of Egypt could truly remain the same God-fearing Joseph whom they had known, for such a way of life was above their level. In fact, not only the brothers, But even the father Jacob, Joseph's own father, when told that Joseph yet lives and rules over Egypt, was apprehensive, lest his son, who had become the absolute ruler of the mighty Egyptian kingdom, was assimilated into Egyptian culture. It was cold comfort to Jacob that his long-lost son still lived, if he had, God forbid, adopted the Egyptian way of life. When his sons explained that Joseph had attained a new and higher level in righteousness and strength of character, Jacob experienced real joy. Only then was he truly satisfied that Joseph, my son, following my way of life, yet lives. That although Joseph was viceroy of Egypt, he still conducted himself as befitted the son of Jacob. May God bless us all with a Yiddish nachas of our children and grandchildren, and may the Almighty reward us with the Geula Shlema. Amen. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Gordon.
January 10th, 1993.
Good evening, Rabbi Gordon.
Good evening, Charlie. Yesterday, Sedre Vayechi opened with the words, "And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years. According to the interpretation of the Balaturim, these years were the best and the most rewarding of Jacob's life. For during this period, Jacob, under the leadership of his son Yehuda, whom he sent to Egypt ahead of the family, set up a yeshiva in Egypt for his grandchildren, and thereby brought a measure of refinement and holiness into the depraved life of that country. And all this he accomplished without compromising or diluting his own beliefs or way of life. The sages of the Mishneh teach us, be a follower of Aaron, love your fellow creatures and draw them to the Torah. The Mishneh does not say people, but brios, fellow creatures, implying that we should show love even toward those individuals who seemingly have no redeeming qualities whatsoever other than they were created by the Almighty and are God's creatures. Even the sequence and order of the Torah's laws has great significance and can teach us a great deal. The very first mitzvah found in the Torah is God's command, be fruitful and multiply. The first precept in the Torah and the first fundamental principle in the life of a Jew is one Jew must try to create another in the spiritual as well as in the physical sense. In other words, every Jew must draw and attract his fellow with sincere affection and friendship to come closer to Torah. Until one makes of their neighbor a better Jew, in a sense creating another Jew. On the other hand, however, we must remember that the wording of the above-mentioned Mishnah is, draw them to the Torah. We must strive to bring them closer to the Torah, and not to bring the Torah down to them by compromising or diluting its laws and customs. There are some who feel that in order to draw Jews nearer to their religion, it is necessary to bring the Torah down to their level. If, for example, we will relax some of the laws governing conditions of worship in the synagogue, many more people, they claim, would then attend services and thereby come closer to Judaism. The argument is, however, utterly false, for the very factor that in the first place caused the current estrangement of some of our people from Yiddishkeit was the watering down of the eternal and everlasting ideals of the Torah. Hence, further compromise, rather than extinguishing the fires of assimilation, are only adding fuel to its flames. And this is the meaning also of the conclusion of yesterday's Torah reading, when we all called out, Chazak, Chazak, Venis Chazek, be strong, and we shall all become stronger. By every one of us standing firm in our commitment to our faith and our people. We are strengthening our brethren all over the world, including Israel, not to surrender, not to compromise, and that way, with God's help, we shall see the speedy redemption in our days soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
January 17th, 1993.
His weekly commentary. Good evening, Rabbi Gordon.
In yesterday's Sefer Shmos, we were told how a handful of Jews, starting with 70 in number, managed to survive on the foreign soil of Egypt in the midst of an overwhelmingly powerful and hostile people. They survived not by imitating their non-Jewish neighbors and trying to hide their identity, but on the contrary, by realizing that they were different, and by guarding most zealously and uncompromisingly their identity and spiritual independence. Our sages pointed out the secret of the Jew's survival in the commentary on the first verse of the Seder, and these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt, because they did not change their names and their customs, they were redeemed from Egypt. Moreover, not only did they manage to survive in spite of such adverse circumstances, but they multiplied in number and grew strong in spirit until they received the Torah at Sinai, bringing light to the entire world and accomplishing the purpose of creation. This portion of the Torah, giving us the story of the first exile, contains the secret of Jewish survival in all dispersions and in all generations. This lesson should especially be remembered in our own day, when the Golus has become so tragically devastating, both physically and spiritually. Jews throughout the world are surrounded by a demoralized and hostile society in which basic principles of humanity and justice are trampled upon, a world so confused that darkness is mistaken for light and light for darkness. In this Golus, we Jews must take to heart more than ever before the teaching of our Torah, which is Torah Chaim, the law of life, that only through the preservation of our identity and spiritual independence, based on the solid foundations of our Torah and mitzvahs, and nurtured through an uncompromising Torah true education of our children, can we ensure the survival of our people spiritually and physically, and moreover grow and prosper. It is only through this truly Jewish way of life that everyone individually and our people as a whole will earn the fulfillment of God's blessing, Kein Yirbe V'Chein Yifrotz, the blessing of growth and prosperity despite adverse circumstances, and we shall merit the true and complete redemption through our righteous Mashiach speedily in our time. Amen.
Thank you, Rabbi Gordon.
January 24th, 1993.
Good evening, Rabbi Gordon.
Good evening, Charlie. A fascinating aspect of the liberation of the Jews from Egypt, the prelude to which is the subject of yesterday's Seder Vaera, is the thrilling and dramatic way in which they experience sudden and complete transformation in both the physical and spiritual sense. In the physical area, the change was extremely dramatic. Imagine the bitterness of the Jews' slavery, enslaved in a country from which not even a single slave can escape, completely in the power of a pharaoh who bathes in blood of Jewish children, in utmost destitution, broken in body and spirit by the meanest kind of forced labor. Suddenly, Pharaoh's power is broken, the entire people is liberated, the former slaves emerge from slavery as free men, bold and dignified, with an outstretched arm, and with great wealth, as the Torah narrative describes it. Israel's spiritual liberation was no less sudden and dramatic. After some have sunk to the lowest degree of unholiness, to the point of pagan idol worship, they suddenly, at the time of the crossing of the Red Sea, perceive God revealed in his full glory. A few weeks later, they all stand at the foot of Mount Sinai on the highest level of holiness and prophecy. God speaks to each one of them individually without any go-betweens, not even Moshe, and declares, I am God, your God. The instructions and teachings of the Torah and the commandments are infinite and eternal, as God himself who gave them to us is infinite and eternal. These instructions are valid for all times and places and can and must be applied in daily life. This is even more true in the case of the Exodus from Egypt, an event which we are ordered by the Torah to remember every day. The instructive message to all of us that stands out in bold letters from the events of the Exodus mentioned earlier is that a Jew has the inner capacity and actual ability to transform himself or herself in a short time from one extreme to the opposite. The message of the liberation from Egypt is especially urgent and timely in our present age, when Jews individually and in groups have woken up and started to look for a way of liberation from their spiritual slavery. They are trying to step onto the road of true freedom of the spirit, above all to free themselves completely from the fear of what will the goyim say. And we refer here to them in every description. It includes also the goyish proddings of misguided Jews and the goyim within each one of us, the Yetzer Hara, one's own inclination to evil. To these freedom seekers, especially the story of the Exodus from Egypt calls out, do not stop, go further, rise higher with an outstretched arm. Your and our liberation will then be complete and certain through Mashiach Tzidkenu. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Rabbi Gordon.
January 31st, 1993.
Good evening, Rabbi Gordon.
Good evening, Charlie. The liberation from Egypt was not merely the freeing of numerous individuals, but the emancipation of a people. It began with God's declaration, I have indeed seen the plight of my people, which induced the demand, let my people go, and ultimately the fulfillment of Moshe's task to take out my people, the children of Israel, from Egypt. One would therefore have expected that the command concerning the Passover lamb sacrifice given in this week's Seder Bowl, a command given just prior to and in conjunction with the Exodus, would emphasize the nation, the idea of collectiveness in unity. Yet the approach was the exact reverse. Each home had to have its own sacrifice. Each Jew was singled out to share in it. Each person had to stay in his home or his group for the duration of the sacrifice meal. By this emphasis on the individual, the Torah teaches us that the way to accomplish liberation, even of an entire people, must begin with concentration on the individual. In the same way, the way for a person to implement a general resolution is through carrying out its details. Attention should be directed not only towards general considerations and all-embracing resolutions, but towards implementing in daily life the various small duties incumbent upon us. It is precisely this approach that eventually brings the deliverance of the whole individual. The individual often makes general resolutions on an all-embracing scale. He determines, for example, to be good and righteous before God and man. He decides to be a good Jew. What great and impressive resolution. But when it comes to giving expression to these all-encompassing undertakings through details and small deeds, it's a different story. When it comes to eating, he does not choose between kosher and non-kosher food, and even if he observes the dietary laws at home, he's not so particular about eating in a trefer restaurant. When it comes to tefillin, he has neither the time nor the patience for this daily detail. When it comes to Shabbos, the details of strict observance irk him, so he disregards them. How, pray, from all these negative details can we put together the picture of a good Jew? It just doesn't add up. The message of Passover sacrifice is crystal clear. Though connected with the liberation of our whole people, the sacrifice emphasized the family unit and the single individual as those through which the liberation could practically be achieved. Similarly, the whole is the sum of parts. The greatest resolution of commitment to Judaism is great and good only when practically implemented and realized through the details and small duties of our mitzvahs, which then add up to a great volume and will bring about the ultimate liberation speedily in our days. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Gordon.
February 14th, 1993.
Good evening, Rabbi Gordon.
Good evening, Charlie. The Saturday Yisro, which we read yesterday, describes Matan Torah, the events surrounding the giving of the Torah. At the time the Torah was given, God told Moshe, "Thus shall you say to the house of Jacob and speak to the children of Israel." Our sages commenting on this verse throw light on the special role of Jewish women at the giving of the Torah. They declare that the expression, the house of Jacob, refers to the women. The Torah here indicates that when the Torah was about to be given, the women were approached first before the men. This emphasizes the women's primary role in the preservation of the Torah in their homes, as well as for the Jewish people as a whole. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai after receiving the Torah, he carried with him two tablets of stone engraved with the Ten Commandments, which contains the quintessence of Torah. Commenting on the words engraved, which in Hebrew is chorus, our sages see in the word chorus the implication of chayrus, liberation, freedom. They go on to explain that true freedom and liberation can only be achieved through the Torah, when it is truly engraved upon the hearts and minds of the Jewish people, men and women alike. For when a Jew lives their daily life in accordance with the Torah, they are truly free, free from servitude to their natural temptations, free from anxiety. The Torah concept of freedom is the very opposite of what nowadays passes for liberation, which really is a clamor for freedom to do as one pleases in order to gratify one's natural appetite without restrictions or inhibitions. This kind of liberation is nothing but an attempt to legalize the lowest animal passions, and there is surely no greater slavery than being a slave to one's own passions. True liberation from enslavement to the self and to the negative aspects of society in which we live can be achieved only by submission to the will of God and the acceptance of the so-called yoke of Torah and Mitzvahs. Only in this way can the Jew attain the highest degree of spiritual development in their daily life and make their life truly worth living. For it is the Torah, Torah Chaim, the Torah of life, which elevates the life of the Jew and gives life true meaning and fulfillment, so that the Jew can realize his destiny of being created in the image of God. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Shalom to the family and friends of the late Rabbi Shalom Gordon. This is Charlie Bernhout speaking. It is now August of 2002, and it is hard to believe that over a year has passed since the death of the beloved Rabbi Gordon. My first involvement with Rabbi Gordon came indirectly through my wonderful bubby, Bessie or Basha Bernhout. When Rabbi Gordon first came to this country, he stayed in a room in my bubby's home. That was in Newark, New Jersey. Needless to say, throughout the years, I always felt proud that my bubby's home was acceptable for the rabbi. It was around 1946, when I was 10 years old, that I first came in close contact with Rabbi Gordon. The Lubavitchers had opened up a cheder in Newark on the corner of Chancellor Avenue and Old Dean Street. I had been going to the Talmud Torah, but then moved to the Lubavitcher cheder when it opened. It was unfortunate that Rabbi Spitz and others taught primarily in Yiddish, which I did not understand. And therefore, I particularly always looked forward to classes with Rabbi Gordon. His impeccable English, his sense of humor, his dedication, and his teaching ability, tied together with his wonderful stories, are what I always remember concerning that period of my life.
After high school, I served 2 years in the Army to get the GI Bill to pay for college. While I was in Japan in 1956, my father died, and when I came home, ready to enter college, I was considering what to do with my life, and I had thoughts of becoming a rabbi. I met with Rabbi Gordon to get his opinion, and he asked me if I had the calling to become a rabbi. I understood what he was trying to tell me, or what he was saying, and I realized that that was not the road that I should take. They say that nothing happens by accident. In October of 1977, I was in my car on my way to my office, and flipping the dial, I heard Jewish music. The young DJ had mentioned that if anyone wanted to announce an upcoming Jewish event, they should call him. At that time, I was chairman of an upcoming dinner for Simon Wiesenthal. When I called the young DJ and asked him to make the announcement, he suggested that I come into the studio the next morning at Uppsala College, and he would interview me. That was how I first met Leiby, or Larry Gordon, Nissen Gordon's son and Rabbi Gordon's nephew. After the interview, I told Larry that I had hundreds of old 78 recordings. I had a major collection of old Victrolas, and people used to throw away their old records. So I had these recordings of Chazonis, Rosenblatt, Hirschman, Kvartin, a lot of Yiddish recordings. Never listened to them, and I offered him the collection. He said that he really wasn't particularly interested in Chazonis or Yiddish, but if I wanted he would give me a half hour every Friday morning to play the records. I took him up on the offer, and that was my first exposure to Jewish music. It then became an obsession. I traveled in my work in real estate and visited every thrift shop, old record store, every Jewish record store, and so forth. And today I have a collection of over 11,000 albums of Jewish music. In 1980, Larry parted ways with the radio station at the WFMU, and I then proceeded to get my own show at Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey. My show, 2 Hours of Jewish Soul, ran for the next 15 years until 1995. Rabbi Gordon, for many of the years, gave Divrei Torah, which you have heard a sample of on these tapes. Besides the music and Rabbi Gordon's Divrei Torah, I also gave extremely pro-Israel commentaries on the show. One evening after an interview with a friend of mine who was active in JDL, some Arabs complained to the Monsignor at Seton Hall University, and I was unceremoniously retired. For many years, I was very active in supporting the Rabbinical College in Morristown through my radio show and other activities. Because my show was the only show in America that featured 1 hour of Chazonis every week, I had the pleasure of meeting many lovers of Chazonis, among them Rabbi Israel Gordon, Rabbi Shalom Gordon's brother. I frequently attend the Chabad of the Upper East Side, that's Rabbi Krasniansky's shul, and one Shabbos, I heard an outstanding Devar Torah by a young man. I wasn't surprised to learn that he was a son-in-law of the rabbis, Yochanan Rivkin. Rabbi Gordon was a saintly person, to say the least, missed by all. His legacy lives on through his exceptional family and through the loving memories that each of us have of him. Shalom.